auditorium. And we got a tremendous response, not only from the truck drivers and inside workers of 574, but from the rank and file of other unions and from unorganized employed workers and from unemployed workers. And here again, as we had done with Olson, we used some of the city politicians. There was one alderman. He had the kind of a voice, he didn't need a loudspeaker. He anticipated electronics. That man could call a hog in Arkansas from the northwest corner of Nebraska. And he was a vain, a pompous, a self-seeking, big-voiced, pea-sized-minded man. And we found his contradiction, and we put him on record for the second strike by the device of making him marshal of the parade and giving him a white horse to ride. And he did. He did. He did. As they say in Missouri, where I come from, there's more than one way to nub ducks, you know. And in this way, we involved, again, the union bureaucrats and the reformist politicians while we were mobilizing the ranks. And some speeches were made at the auditorium that were somewhat akin to the speeches I described to you last night that were made at the settlement of the coal strike. They're sure Olson will get this thing straightened out. We must understand Olson, and we're not going to have to strike and so on. But Bill Brown was the last speaker, and Bill was a natural-born orator. I contend generally that before anybody can speak at all, you got to think a little about it, you got to study it a little, you got to practice it a little. But every once in a while, somebody comes along, it's a natural, and Bill was one. I've seen him sit down just 5 minutes before a meeting, take an envelope and put about 6 words on the back of the envelope and get up and make a stem-winder speech. And that's exactly what he did at this meeting. We got about 25,000 people in this huge municipal auditorium. Brown's the last speaker, and he winds up his speech with the statement, "The only good boss is a dead boss." The next morning, the papers are out. Oh, boy, long editorials, and the theme is Brown's formula. And they really went to town. Well, it was an extremist statement, you know. But what is it that we've heard lately, you know, about extremism in defense of liberty? But anyway, we had him involved. Now we're at the eve of strike. And another breed of domestic political animal capitalist variety steps in, namely the federal mediator. A fellow by the name of Dunnigan, mediator assigned by the Department of Labor in Washington. I always remembered him. He wore pince-nez glasses with a black ribbon, had a row of cigars in the pocket where I got these glasses. Come to the strike headquarters, we're getting ready for the next battle. Comes in, introduces himself. Typical line of the mediator. This is a law with mediators in class struggle. Their role is to come in and pretend they're the friend of the workers, get the workers to give them confidence, give them authority, and then go sell you out. Their function is not to attain justice in any way, shape, or form for a working man or woman. Their justice is to prevent a strike from taking place if they can. And if one starts to get it stopped just as quick as they can, with as little as possible for the workers, but above all, get it stopped. Dunnigan comes in. Well, he just got to town. Apparently, he didn't read much. And he thought he was talking to a run-of-the-mind group of workers that just come from nowhere, as was happening all over the country then, just organizing and wondering how we're organized, what we're going to do, how we go about it, and looking for somebody to give him some advice. He tells us, "I understand your problem. Now, you give me the authority, and I'm going to go over and I'll talk to the governor. I'll get the governor to cooperate with me, and I'll go talk to the bosses. And you give me a little latitude here, and I'll bring you back a settlement." We said, "Well, Mr. Dunnigan, we appreciate your generous gesture, your magnificent demonstration of recognition that there's some justice on our side, but I'll tell you what you do." That's what we told them. "You go over and you see the bosses. You come back and tell us what the boss has said, and then we'll tell you whether we like it or not." Well, we got into the strike, and came to a new climactic point in a second mediator commandment by the name of Father Haas, who was part of a special federal mediation service that had been set up, and he and Dunnigan worked as a team. Now, I'm getting ahead a little, but I want to talk about mediators for a moment. At one juncture, our negotiating committee is meeting with Haas and Dunnigan, still no direct meetings with the bosses, and they've given us what they consider a settlement, and they demand that we recommend it to the ranks. Our negotiating committee said, no, we won't. Oh, just let me point out, this is a very important thing about negotiating, talking about tactics. It's fatal to send your negotiators into a negotiation with power to settle, because they're behind the eight ball. They're subject to get shoved off in the room, and all the pressure in the world is put on them. And you put your negotiators and the organization itself in jeopardy. The strongest position for a negotiator is never have authority to say yes or no. They'll take it back. It serves the dual function of keeping you in the best possible strategic position in negotiating and minimizing the dangers of somebody weakening and selling you out when they go in there as your negotiator. Haas and Dunnigan tried to do this to our negotiating team, and when it was refused, they demanded the right to go before the Committee of 100 with their proposition. And they were allowed to go before the Committee of 100. And as they were leaving the hall after the meeting, and the workers had told them out in no uncertain terms, you would have witnessed the spectacle of a young Irish Catholic truck driver reach down inside his shirt, rip the crucifix off his neck, and hurl it into the face of the priest mediator as he walked out of the meeting. Class struggle, his very education in many ways. Now, in the second walkout, we very quickly came to the most brutal phase of all the fighting, what is known as Bloody Friday. The police laid a trap, this time in the wholesale grocery district. The police had been equipped with riot guns. It's a shotgun type of weapon that carries a number 4 slug. And it's just one small stage short of a dum-dum bullet. It's a vicious thing. It's a vicious thing. They laid a trap, and they opened fire on the unarmed pickets. They shot down over 50 pickets in a matter of 10 minutes. Most of them shot in the back, trying to escape from the guns. 2 of them killed. The immediate reaction of the workers was to go home and get their revolvers, their shotguns, their deer rifles, souvenir bayonets from World War I, trench knives, anything they could lay hands on for a weapon, and come back to the strike headquarters with it. Seething with anger, intimidated, terrorized, no. And here you have the positive side of the democratic illusion in work. The negative side of it is that until the lessons of class struggle life teaches them otherwise, workers think they really got some democratic rights in this capitalist society in the class analysis. The positive side is when they find out it's not so, as these workers were finding out, then the positive side comes forward, in the sense that they fight for what they truly thought were their rights that they feel are being taken away, and they look at the cop as the violator of the law of the land, not themselves, and they propose to take the law in their own hands, that first and fundamental law that's basic to all nature, the law of self-defense. The duty of the strike leadership was to disarm them. It wasn't a pleasant task, but you'll find the more you attain responsibility as a leader, that there's a lot about being a leader that is not pleasant. Anybody that wants to have a lark, to have a good thing with all kinds of honors, not too much responsibility, and feel that you're free from problems because you can decide, don't ever set out to be a leader, because that's not the way it is. That's not the way it is. A leader has got to be conscious, and a leader has got to know why and how sometimes to do things that at that moment of rage the workers can't understand. And believe you me, it's not easy. But if the leadership had just stood supinely and let the workers go out on the streets and take after those cops, in those circumstances, the kind of a bloodbath would have developed that would have been inherent in the situation, we'd have had the whole federal army in Minneapolis in no time at all. You couldn't win. You couldn't win. So the duty of the leadership was to disarm those strikers, send them out without arms. Now, what saved the situation was a combination of the anger, the determination of the workers, and the new waves of support. The bosses thought they were terrorizing. If anything, we got more support. Around town, the minute the city learned about Bloody Friday than we'd had before. The anger, the determination that came out of that, the fact we had these flying squadrons by this time so skillfully organized and tooled and manned and led, and the fact the cops didn't know the leadership had disarmed the strikers. Those were the things that saved the situation. The cops began to escort one truck at a time. You had the spectacle. They would take a truck, anything, whatever, and there would be a convoy of about 40 prowl cars. Four cops to a car, four riot guns sticking out the windows of the prowl car like machine guns out of a tank. 20 of them in front of the truck, 20 behind, and they would always go right through the heart of the downtown sector for the demonstration. And you would find 80 picket cars flanking the 40 carloads of cops. So you'd have three abreast, the cops in the middle, two lines of picket cars. We wouldn't try to stop it, but we just added to the parade. And the cops didn't know whether or not there were guns in those picket cars, and you know, they really didn't want to find out. Well, the cops do this a couple of times, and then they would begin to reduce the number of squad cars to a truck. And the minute they reduced the number of squad cars, we'd redouble the number of picket cars. And this would convince them that we're going to begin stopping them now. And they'd shift back. And it just became tug and saw here, and it became impossible for them. Olson had to intervene. So he cooked up a scheme with Haas and Dunnigan. They came up with what they called the Haas-Dunnigan plan. It was a lousy thing, but it did have union recognition. It did grant a certain recognition of the right to an increase in pay. It did recognize drivers and inside workers. It did have the seniority clause. It did have certain regulations on hours and overtime. It did have a guarantee that all strikers will be returned their job without discrimination. And Olson announced that the Haas-Dunnigan plan is going to be presented to the union and to the bosses, and if it is rejected by either side, he is going to declare martial law and enforce the Haas-Dunnigan plan as the terms of settlement of the strike. Now, it was laid for us, naturally. But here again, we managed to outthink them. A deadline was set of noon on a certain day. I think it was a Saturday. It was a very hot day, I remember. We met in a big hall over on the east side in Minneapolis. Why I remember it was hot was because we wanted to make sure, the deadline was noon, we wanted to make sure that the bosses didn't get any word until the deadline as to the union action. As we figured, the bosses would count on us rejecting the settlement, and then they would accept it, and Olson would turn the guard loose on us. We closed all the windows. We had thousands of men in this huge auditorium. We closed all the windows, and we had ourselves a meeting. All the workers were sore about it. It was an unfair, rotten settlement, But we thrashed it out there. We debated it from every point of view, and we came out with a unanimous vote that the workers understood of the tactical necessity of the union accepting the Haas-Dunnigan plan. We told them, we don't think the bosses are going to accept it. We don't think this is going to end the strike, but you have to assume that possibility, but this is why we got to do it. And we'd made the decision a couple of hours before the deadline, and with everybody's agreement, and everybody just sweltering and suffering, we sat there till just a few minutes before the deadline. Bill Brown went to the telephone, called the governor, and said, the union accepts the Haas-Dunnigan plan. The bosses hadn't said a word. A couple hours later, they announced they accepted with reservations, which was that they didn't accept it at all. And with this, Olson declared martial law and installed the National Guard headquarters in the armory in downtown Minneapolis, threw the troops out on the streets. Pretty soon you had these farm boys, their bayonets, walking back and forth under the awnings, the stores downtown, and getting the bayonet caught in the awning and damn near cutting their throat. But he announces that out at the any employer comes out to the National Guard headquarters and signs the Haas-Dunnigan plan can operate. So all the small fry bosses, little one-horse outfits that never intended to live up to anything they signed anyway, they all rush down and sign. Pretty soon all the trucks of these little operators are out with a big poster on the front of the windshield, operating by permission of the military authorities under the Haas-Dunnigan plan. And we go this way for a while, and big bosses begin to put the heat on. They take Olson to court and try to get an injunction against martial law, and then they start claiming that this is interfering with interstate commerce. We're depriving sick people in hospitals. All the pressures in the world are put on, and little by little, Olson begins to let other trucks operate under military control. In short, he's beginning to break the strike on a piecemeal basis. So we held a protest rally of the union at a big public playground known as the Parade Grounds, where we denounced this whole thing and announced to one and all that the union is going out the next day, and whether or not there's any tin hats along, if a truck is on the streets that the owner hasn't signed up and under the Haas-Dunnigan plan, we're going to stop it. Well, about 4 o'clock the next morning, some of us are in the headquarters, and suddenly we hear, as the poets say, the measured tread of booted feet. The National Guard is marching up the street from the army and surrounding the strike headquarters. They surround the whole block and they train machine guns on the front doors of the headquarters that the picket cars came in and out of. And the colonel in command of the guard, a judge from Duluth, Minnesota, comes in and announces he's taking possession. And he's got a list of the names of the leaders of the strike. And don't think the bosses didn't know who the leaders were. He didn't have any of the formal executive board. He had the real leadership of the strike on his list. They got some of the leaders. The first one they got was Ray Dunn. One or two of us managed to get through the police lines or the military lines by a ruse. And they had set up a military stockade at the state fairground out in the edge of town. They threw all the leaders they could grab in there, and they began arresting pickets and throwing them in there. And in the headquarters were still all these guns and bayonets and butcher knives we'd taken away from the pickets on Bloody Friday. And so the military, they sort all these out, and they've got them laid out on a table, all tagged. Newspapers come in, take pictures of them. The evening papers have got huge pictures, you know, of this arsenal that is found in the strike headquarters. But meantime, Olson has sent word through the union bureaucrats that he wants to meet a rank-and-file committee of the union, and here's where the secondary leaders come into the picture. Secondary leaders that have been developing in the strike committee of 100. Olson meets them in the offices of the Labor Review, the official paper of the Central Labor Union, in case you don't think there was some conniving going on between Olson and the bureaucrats. They come in, the Olson, he was an old dock walloper. When he was with workers, he liked to play the worker angle. He chewed Yankee Girl tobacco. And he'd workers there, he liked to put his feet up on a table and get a gobloon over and take a chew of tobacco and spit, you know, and talk workers' language. And so he pulls his tobacco out of his pocket and starts passing around this rank and file committee. It happened to be Kelly Postal, Ray Rainbolt, and Jack Maloney. A couple of three pretty tough cookies as they go. He passes the pack around, they take it, and by the time he gets back to the governor, there's no Yankee Girl. So he has to sit there and look at his spittoon while the rank and file committee chooses tobacco. He gives them a song and dance, and they tell him, "All right, we want to be reasonable. Now, just a couple of things we want you to do, Governor." "Well, anything within reason. What is it you want?" "Well, they say, one, let our leaders out of your stockade. Two, give us back our strike headquarters. Three, take your troops off the streets. Then we'll be willing to talk contract with you. Meantime, those of us in the central leadership that the military hadn't managed to grab, together with the others on the strike committee of 100, have organized auxiliary headquarters all over town, generally using friendly filling stations. And a little mayhem is being committed, not only on the trucks on the street, but on some soldiers, too." It was quite an afternoon. The casualty lists in the paper the next morning made somewhat instructive and interesting reading for statisticians that like to study things like that from that point of view. Between what's happening to his tin hats and the scab trucks that he's let loose under military protection and the hard time he's having with the rank and file committee and the editorial office's Labor Review, Olson decided he had to back off. So he admitted finally that it was a mistake. They had claimed that we hadn't had a permit for our public rally the night before, which we had, by the way. He knew it, but now he says a mistake, and he orders the military to restore the headquarters. Amusing thing, one of the secondary leaders of the strike goes up, and he thought justice is justice, and among other things, he made the commander of the military detachment that was holding down the headquarters account on his own inventoried list for every revolver, rifle, shotgun, trench knife, and what have you that they had seized the day they raided the headquarters. We got the headquarters back, and it developed into a sitz creek. Olson had to back off. The police hadn't been able to break the strike. They hadn't been able to break the strike with the military. They hadn't been able to outflank the leadership of the strike and defeat the strike by tricking the membership. See the value of a tightly knit, democratically organized, consciously functioning machine when you're in a battle? What were they going to do? It developed into a sitz creek. It settled down, in fact, to a war of nerves, to a process of attrition. We were pretty worn down by that, I can tell you. This battle had been going on quite a while. But here's another important thing to keep in mind. In these kind of clutches, and you're in a fight, you know, and you're beginning to feel awful tired, always remember the other guy is not necessarily as fresh as a daisy anymore. And if you can hang on just a little bit longer by the skin of your teeth, sometimes you'll win. You know, this theme novelists are so fond of using about how one guy is slicker than another and he's just pounding the devil out of him in a fist fight because of his superior skill, but the other guy is more rugged and he's taking it. He can seldom get a blow in, and all of a sudden he found he's won because the other guy just falls from exhaustion. He can't throw another punch. these factors operate in struggles of this kind. And just when we were on the ropes and actually beginning to talk about the problem of how to call off the strike and at least get some of the best militants back on the job if we could, the bosses folded. It took the form of a special mediator coming in as a face-saving device and a formula that was a sort of a combination of the Haas-Dunnigan plan and the utilization of the collective bargaining election through the National Labor Relations Board that had appeared in the case of the coal strike, was put together, and on that basis, the bosses agreed to a settlement that, while it wasn't what the workers deserved, as it was looked over in a cold, hard, and calculated way, we had to recognize it was much as we could get at the time. It legalized the union and the industry, and it gave us the point of departure to go ahead now with the union building job. And on that basis, we settled the strike. At a membership meeting where the terms of settlement were read and freely discussed. And another thing to remember about strikes, about all actions, while some people are too quick to quit, and there's that key problem I just mentioned of trying to hang on a little longer because maybe the opposition is worse off than you are, there are always some that don't know when to quit. And when the terms of settlement are read and recommended by the leadership and the situation explained, one of the drivers gets up and says, "What's happened to the leaders of this union? Have you lost your guts?" With that note, in our next session, and I won't speak as long as I have tonight, I'll go into how we consolidated a union and made a magnificent fighting instrument of it with that kind of workers and that kind of a situation. Organized into what was known as the Women's Auxiliary of Local 574. The action was formalized at a general membership meeting of the union on the eve of the first general driver strike in May. And as a formal official auxiliary body of the union, they then proceeded to select their own executive committee, and in general, they set up a structure among the women acting in this semi-formal organizational basis in support of the strike that roughly paralleled the structure I described for the operation of the internal democratic aspects of the organization in the union itself. The number of women that function in an organized way represented at the high point what you could term as a central cadre of a few hundred that were more or less a continuing force through thick and thin in all stages performed the function. At one another stage, depending on the ebb and flow of the tides of battle, as I have described them here tonight, women in far more substantial numbers would come forward. For example, I gave the illustration in terms of pickets, of the response to the shooting by the police on Bloody Friday. There was a parallel upsurge of the women in the same sense.
Joe?
At what stage in the struggle did the workers become aware that the leadership was possible?
That's a point I had meant to deal with, and I hope somebody would ask that. I had to leave it out. I spoke, I think, too long as it was. Right from the coal strike in February, the workers became aware of the presence of the Trotskyists in the union because the bosses, through the kept press, began red-baiting, and the union bureaucrats, sometimes surreptitiously, sometimes more openly, depending on how things were going, began to echo this. It did not have any effect on the workers. Not because the workers were politically conscious, not because they had arrived at a principal understanding that the concept of excluding radicals from the unions was antithetical to the good and welfare of the working class, but because of the realities of the situation. Here again you have another manifestation of the power inherent in an organized body of workers, despite a relatively low level of political consciousness, to meet a situation of the moment, at least, out of a democratically structured union organization. The workers knew good and well that the union concept, the union demands, the battle the union was waging was not something that was being shoved down their throats by the leaders. They knew the leaders were leading them by example, by convincing them, by consulting them. They believed in everything that was being done, and they didn't care what the leaders were. They could have been men from Mars. That didn't make any difference. The all-important thing to them was whether or not you were on the right side, whether or not you were leading in the interest of the workers and being a good leader, and they had confidence in you. Now, here again, the strike daily became very valuable. We got a real stab in the back from Tobin in the period following the May strike, and as we were coming to the critical juncture in the July-August strike, the second strike I described, Tobin wrote a blast against the Trotskyists in Local 574 in a big editorial in the Teamsters Journal, the official magazine of the International Union. It was published monthly. The bosses took this editorial of Tobin's and bought full-page ads in the daily papers, every daily paper in town. There were three of them, and ran it in full under blazing headlines. It was answered by a story in the Daily Organizer under the title Bughouse Fable. It was written anonymously, but I guess it's all right to say now it was actually written by Jim Cannon. And it was a satire. There's supposed to be a hearing before the military tribunal. And the editor of the Organizer is testifying, and the judge advocate presiding at this military hearing is demanding to know about the Trotskyites, and particularly about the Dunn brothers. And it starts out, the editor admits, yes, there are Dunn brothers in the union. As a matter of fact, there are 17 of them. They're all the same age. They were smuggled into this country as outside agitators disguised as bags of Irish potatoes. This is the way the thing opened. And it goes on, you know, just ridiculing the whole thing, and then comes the snapper. The Dunn brothers, just before they sneaked into the country this way, had gone to see Trotsky, who was in Prinkipo. And Trotsky had said to them, "Boys, the line is, I want a revolution in Minneapolis before snow flies, and I want you to get 42.5 cents an hour for the inside workers and 52.5 cents an hour for the truck drivers, because that's communism." And said, just as they were leaving, Trotsky called them back and he said, "Boys, one final word. Watch out for old Sonovich. He's liable to double-cross you any minute." That just blew the whole red-baiting. Bosses, Tobin, union bureaucrats and all, right out of the water.
Bloody Friday, you mentioned about the trail. I thought maybe it'd be valuable to learn
not only to terrorize workers, but an attempt to win public opinion to their side. I think they disguised it as a phony hospital truck, if I recall. And actually, the workers had always allowed provisions to hospitals, and how it rebounded against them.
The episode of the hospital truck occurred on Thursday, the day before Bloody Friday, and we let it go through. They had already obviously had the stage set. They thought we were going to try to stop that, and that's what they intended to do. So the next day, they saw that we weren't going to fall for this, so the next day they just proceeded to load a truck in a routine way out of one of the wholesale grocery houses that was going to start delivering stuff to stores. And I say it was a trap. It was an ambush, is what it was. They didn't have too many cops around. Now, our intention had been to have a substantial line there and let it be a mass demonstration. We knew that barehanded, you know, we couldn't wade into these riot guns the way we'd waded into the clubs. But they had the cops planted in the alleys and the side streets and off a little distance in their prowl cars. And when the pickets began to get mobilized, some of the pickets that were shot were still in the trucks in which they were transported to the point where we were going to start demonstrating against this attempt to move the truck. And all they waited for was to just get enough pickets there to make it interesting for them, and they opened fire.
Now I wanted to ask a little more about the red baiting across this track. I understood from reading American City that most of the workers, well, not most, but all of the friends of the Dunn brothers in Minneapolis, they had roots in the area, and it is widely known that they were, well, first they were members of the Communist Party, then afterwards that they were Trotskyists. That it was just something that was known, that his boss knew that one of them was a communist for years before he fired him. And is this true or not?
Yes, it is true that the bosses knew the political background and general record of the Dunn brothers, Skoglund, such comrades. It is equally true that, by and large, the union bureaucrats knew about it. Those who didn't know about it, however, were the overwhelming mass of the rank-and-file strikers and the supporters of the strikers, because they were just coming into the union movement for the first time and had little and in many cases no knowledge of factors of this kind or of the political background of the leaders, except as it was brought forward to them in these forms in the boss propaganda. Their tendency was a combination of receiving it more or less as just some more boss lies, in one sense, because they knew the bosses were lying about everything else. It was demonstrated to them day after day after day that the newspapers were coming out with reports that oftentimes were just the polar opposite of what the realities were of what was taking place on the streets and the strikes. They were aware of that. And so there was a tendency to dismiss it, and in the second place, for the reasons I stated before, a tendency to say, well, even if it's so, what's the difference? They're good leaders.
Well, what about the workers that work with these? There are different people that they work with every day. I had the impression that their political views were known among their friends and so forth.
Well, what I'm trying to convey to you is that consciousness of it, in the sense you speak, of knowledge of their background, was present among very few people. There were a few people, and here I should say, by the way, that those who knew within the union movement in this sense were really only the key cadre people that had come into the structure out of the coal yards. Not all the workers in the coal yards were fully aware of it, to say nothing of the other workers.
How many members would you say were in the Minneapolis branch of the party beginning this strike?
Well, don't hold me to the exact number. But if memory serves me right, on the eve of the coal strike, there were, probably 25 to 35 in all categories, including the newest ones. Following the coal strike, recruitment began to develop to the point that there were probably 50 to 60 by the time of the May strike. And then recruitment developed on a gradual basis after that until it began to climb up into the vicinity of 100, a steady, sort of a steady process of growth. I should say, by the way, here again, one of the interesting examples of a limited situation. We arrived at that point where you had to begin very carefully screening people who applied for membership in the party, just like the Bolshevik Party had the problem after the revolution. It was one thing, you remember in the Russian Revolution, for a person to join the party before October. But after October, all the opportunists tried to swarm in, you know, because this just appeared to be the road to get in on the inside track and get a good post. In a certain sense, we had the same problem in the Union. Once it became established that the Socialist Workers' Party contained within itself the key leaders of Local 574, and that being in the party did not prevent you from being in the Union, the opportunists put two and two together and said, well, we better get into the party so we got a better chance of getting on the Union payroll. Well, it didn't work out that way, but that's what they tried. Let me divide that into the two categories, police and National Guard. In the case of the police, here's what happened. You can say it was a laboratory example of the making of a cop in the complete sense of what the role of a cop is in capitalist society. Prior to the strikes, the truck drivers had looked upon the cops in a friendly way. Oh, this cop they don't like because he's too quick to give them a ticket for making an illegal left turn or overparking or something like that. Just kind of a mean-minded cop that gives a working man a hard way to go. Other cops would give him a break, were very friendly. Well, from the workers' side, one of the cops that got one of the worst beatings in the Monday fight, which I repeat was the real battle. One of the cops that got one of the worst beatings had been one that most truck drivers looked upon as their special friend in the police department. And what they were reacting to was the sense of outrage that their friend would turn against them. As the second strike developed, this happened among the cops. When the chief of police issued the riot guns, a few cops refused to take them, were immediately discharged from the force. A few more cops went down to the wholesale grocery district with the guns and refused to use them when they got there. They were discharged from the force. A few more cops came back, they had used their guns, and they came back, turned in their guns and their badges and quit the police force. And what happened was what always happened, that some cops changed between the period of the opening of the coal strike and the termination of the second general strike, But the change was not in cops on the police force. The change was that the cops who remained on the force were now complete cops. And if we had time to go into many other things, I could tell you some very interesting stories about the battles in 1935, where we run up against these cops and they now had armored cars. And the workers developed new techniques, like it didn't take any time at all for the strikers to figure out the way to put out an armored car is just get a light bulb, tap the end of it off very carefully and fill it with thin paint and put some wax on it and hurl it at the windshield of an armored car. You get paint splattered all over the glass, and the cops can't see where they're going. Meantime, they're tossing tear gas bombs out of the portholes in the armored car. You have a pair of canvas gloves with leather faces, and you pick up one of these tear gas cans, and you just slip it back in the porthole. Next thing you know, the cops come swarming out, and you welcome them. And you kind of put the tear gas can back in there and tell them to divide it among themselves. Now, in the case of the military, here, of course, you're dealing with a combination, a citizens' army and a, shall we say, semi-professional officer corps. Semi-professional in the dual sense that the officer corps in the National Guard is a combination of people that are in one or another kind of a career commission post in the military by reserve status in the regular army at the same time that they're functioning in the National Guard, and also by the fact that by and large the National Guards are officered by carefully selected members of the ruling class. As you know, the military formation in terms of the officer caste is very carefully attuned and adjusted from the ruling by the ruling class from this point of view. Now, it doesn't mean that under any and all circumstances there couldn't be a friend of a strike even among this group. Just as sometimes a person of some wealth will be sympathetic to a revolutionary party out of ideological conviction. But it's not the average, and it depends upon the scope, the depth, the length, the motion of social struggle as a whole on a more sustained basis. Then there are the rank and file. Some members of the National Guard were workers. In a large sense, the National Guard had been a kind of a social institution for them, in a way. This is the first time in a long, long time that the Guard had ever been used in a situation of this kind. And they were very reluctant about what they did, and here and there we got a little tip from members of the rank and file of the National Guard troops on the streets. We learned of cases after the event where they'd get an order from the military command that the pickets are working over a Fink truck driver at such and such a street, and they'd have trouble finding the street. They'd get lost and manage to get there about 15 minutes after they were supposed to have, and all they could do was pick up what was left of the truck and so on. Then some of the farmer kids. You had interesting examples. One night was just after we'd gotten the headquarters back, and just after we'd had some pretty rough clashes with the troops out around the streets, along about 11 o'clock at night, some farmer boy from somewhere out in western Minnesota comes wandering up and wanders into the strike headquarters. He said, "Hey, you guys, I suppose this is going to be over sometime. I'd like to have a little souvenir of it. Suppose I could have one of them there union buttons to take home to show the kinfolk." you run into all kinds of people. But again, in the National Guard, in a somewhat different sense, what happened was that there were a lot of withdrawals from the National Guard at the first opportunity after the event, because now many that had got caught in this that didn't like it, didn't believe it, and didn't want to do anything about it, and actually in one way or another did what they could to help the strike, saw they were in the wrong thing and they got out. I might add a personal experience I had with an old 30-year man, a top sergeant in the regular army, during the over-the-road days. Happened to be sitting in the club car of a railroad train with him, riding from one town to another and having a couple of drinks, and we got talking, and by this time the CIO struggles were developing. He was very interested. He told me that a lot of the guys in the army are watching what's going on. But he says to me, he says, "I want to tell you one thing, fella." He says, "If it gets to the point where it looks like some of us got a chance to do something we'd like to do to maybe help you a little bit."
Is there any support from students in high schools or colleges? Was that a factor at all? Were they interested in the strike or sympathetic?
Oh, yes. It was a very definite factor. And as a matter of fact, my thought had been to just kind of symbolize the whole process when I gave the description of where our couriers came from, the category that they came from. But that was very widely true of the youth. And I might add that at that juncture and in general, the campuses and the high schools were affected by the social crisis of the time to an even far greater degree than it is the case today, where apart from the Negro people, the college and high school youth of this country, although they're not yet moving in that direction in mass terms as the Negro people are a part of the vanguard of those who are beginning to react with an anti-capitalist connotation to the development of their thought to the crisis of society today. Right after the strikes, leaders of the union were very frequently invited to speak before student meetings. I remember another little touch about Bill Brown, if you don't mind. He was speaking at a big meeting in the Northrop Auditorium at the University of Minnesota to students about the strikes. Bill opened his speech. He had quite a wry sense of humor. He opened his speech by saying to the students, he says, "You know, I feel I really got something in common with you." He says, "I was almost a college man myself." He says, "I think I'd have made it if they hadn't have drafted me out of the third grade into the Army." I can only give you this simple answer, that we didn't have yet the forces and resources, we didn't yet have the basis in the union to swing it. Perhaps I can answer it best by saying that this question helps to emphasize and underline the fact that the development of the instrumentality of the organizing committee as the actual leadership of the union was formative, and there was yet a semblance of dual authority. Remember, I described how we had to go before the executive committee and get an authorization just to spend enough money to put out one leaflet to call the workers to a meeting. And I told you the response we got to that, that although we got it through, there was not yet the premise for undertaking as large an action as that. And we had perforce to leave steps of that kind to the process of consolidation that I described that took place, in which the changing situation became formalized, at least in action, if not yet in a constitutional sense, in the Union in the period following the May strike. And it was only then that we were in a position to execute that particular phase of the development of the fighting instruments of the Union.
Any more questions? Okay, then we will terminate this second of four lectures, and tomorrow night we will have another lecture, 7:30 from